Mental illness is epidemic in America, and the problem is spreading worldwide. It's time for decisive action, because the battle for the mind is part of a much larger war being waged between good and evil, with you as the prize. Welcome to Simple Solutions with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Timothy Jennings. For the next hour, we'll uncover Bible-based weapons for fighting destructive feelings and resolving inner conflicts. Dr. Jennings wants to arm you with the tools necessary for achieving emotional and mental stability as you strengthen your relationship with God. We'll open the phone lines for your questions in just a moment. I'm your Simple Solutions host, Charles Mills. Welcome to the program. Today we discuss a topic that many people would rather we not discuss. Why? Because some of the greatest heartbreaks ever experienced by humankind have come about because of this action taken by a loved one. Also, terrible sorrow has resulted when complete strangers commit this act and force others to suffer the consequences right along with them. September 11, 2001 is a painful example. Suicide is a destructive force in anyone's life, especially for those left behind. Today, Dr. Jennings offers some insights into this irreversible act and brings to mind some alternate avenues to take if you're contemplating ending your own life. He'll also offer help to those of us who are left in the wake when someone we know willingly removes him or herself from this veil of tears. Dr. Jennings, let's begin with a simple question. Is suicide ever the right response to life's challenges?
You know, that's a really broad question, and I think the question has to be asked with another question. It depends on how we define suicide. Suicide, when people hear the word, they usually always think of it in a negative sense. But in the military, have you ever heard of people going out on what they call suicide missions? Okay. Missions that are designed to save somebody, to rescue somebody, but they call them suicide missions because they don't expect to come back from them. Would we say that would be something they should not get involved in? So again, it depends on how do we use the definition suicide? Is it simply an act of taking one's own life? Is it an act that we know will result in our death, but for another purpose, the purpose of saving others? I mean, you could even say Christ came on a suicide mission, not the intent to kill himself, but the intent to save us, knowing it would cost him his life to do so.
So you're saying that suicide under certain circumstances is justified if it is benefiting other people. But Dr. Jennings, there are people who commit suicide thinking that their suicide is going to benefit other people. They say, they can't live with me, I can't live with them, I'm causing problems in their lives, so I'm going to off me so that they can have a better life. Yeah. What's wrong with that line of thinking?
Yeah, you know, I think that the real motive comes down to the heart motive. If we are interested in loving other people and helping other people, we're really interested in escaping and protecting self or doing something that's self-centered in nature, and we can then rationalize away, well, you know, I'm doing this for other people. In reality, I deal with patients in my practice all the time who struggle with suicidal thoughts. And as you say, many of them will suggest, well, my family would be better off. I'm a burden. I'm in chronic pain. I can't work like I used to, da-da-da-da-da-da. The reality is, if they actually check with the family members don't experience them that way. It wouldn't be a relief to the family. The family would not want them to kill themselves. So when they come along with this argument, well, it would be a blessing for my family if I were to take my life, that's actually a distortion of the reality. It's not reality.
If there is someone listening right now who has those thoughts, who is saying, you know, the world would be better off without me, my family would be much better off with me, should they just go to the family and say, hey, I got a question for you? How would they do that? How would they take care of that problem?
Well, I think they have to step back and first, suicide, in my experience, people contemplate suicide when we talk about the generally thought of suicide, somebody in their room doing something to end their own life, not somebody out on a mission to save others, like a soldier going into a very difficult time, or even the case of Samson in the Bible, where Samson, took an act that he knew was going to end his life, but he was really focusing on another purpose. If he could have done it and escaped, he would have done it. He had no intention to die. And I think that is the issue. These people on suicide suicide missions in the military have no intention to die. They want to come home. They don't want to end their life. It's not their desire to die, but they're willing to lay down their life for another. That's different than the people who actually have the intention to kill themselves. And I think if you parse that, then again, we come to a different definition of suicide. Suicide isn't simply taking a course of action that you know may result in the ending of your life. It's the purposeful ending of your life and not wanting to save your life, even if you could save your life.
All right, I'm getting it now. The willingness to lay down your life is a whole lot different than the taking of your life. Okay, all right, we're on the right track here. We're getting going on this thing. So I think we're identifying now the suicide that is causing the heartbreak, and that is the suicide that, as far as those of us left behind, we say, why? Why did this person do this? Why did they leave us like this? And there's a lot of anger involved with this. So that's the suicide we're talking about here, that seems to us to be a senseless suicide, a senseless taking of life. Dr. Jennings, in your experience in dealing with patients, are there any warning signs that you listen for when you're talking to this patient in your office that you're saying in the back of your mind, there's a problem here? Are there any warning signs that you could hear?
Yeah, suicide, just to lay some groundwork for the audience, the National Institute of Mental Health statistics indicate that more than 32,000 deaths occur every year in the United States due to suicide. It's the 11th leading cause of death. Basically, every 16 minutes, somebody ends their life by suicide. For people ages 10 to 14 and 15 to 19, it's the third leading cause of death for young adults. Third leading cause of death is suicide. Accidents, I believe, are still number one. Yeah. Caucasians, 12.9 out of every 100,000 end their life by suicide is basically the statistics. So they have the highest rate in the population. And 90% of all people who die by suicide, 9 out of 10, have some mental health disorder either. Then the most common three are a mood disorder, like depression or bipolar disorder, a substance use disorder, or schizophrenia.
And 9 out of 10. Okay, that's significant. That's significant because as you look at suicide, as you look at suicidal records and everything, if you say 9 out of 10 have some type of other disorder,
right,
then it suddenly puts suicide in a little bit different light.
That's right. That's right. And my experience about people who commit suicide is that when we're again talking about the not the person who's on a mission and knows their life might be taken, but would save their life if they could, but people who are actually intent on ending their life. I've never experienced somebody who wanted to actually end their life who wasn't in some form of pain for which they thought they would never get relief. So they're in pain of some sort, physical pain, emotional pain, relational pain, psychological pain, spiritual pain, some type of pain, and they believe that they will never recover from it. They will never be relieved. They will never get through it. So what I'm putting together here is suffering and loss of hope. Those two things together, suffering without hope of relief, results in the desire for suicide, not truly as a way to end one's life, but as a way of escape from the suffering. And if you ask patients, ask patients who are suicidal, if I had two buttons on the wall, one you hit, you end your life right this moment. The other you hit, and you're healthy, you're happy, you feel good. Whatever problems, your finances are resolved, your marriage is healthy, your son who just got killed in a car wreck is resurrected. Whatever it is, if you could reverse whatever's causing the suffering and take it away, almost all of them choose to hit the one in which the suffering is taken away, and they continue to live. There very, very rarely is a person truly want to die if they can have suffering removed and have a happy life. People want to live. People come to suicide when they find themselves in a circumstance which they believe their life is, quote unquote, over in some way. And what they mean by that is a happy, healthy, hope for some rewarding life is over. And all they see is pain, suffering, humiliation, embarrassment, something like that. And that's why they turn to suicide as an escape is often the case.
Well, we are going to discuss this more at length. I'm going to open the phone lines right now, caller. If you have a question or comment, here's the number, 800-775-4673. That's 800-775-4673. We'll be back with Dr. Jennings in just a minute, so don't go away.
Here's Dr. James Markham with your daily heartbeat.
In this world, there are many pollutants out there. Some of you might be driving and smell all the fumes out there. You might live in polluted cities, and there might be all sorts of things that you're breathing that God didn't want us to have. One of the best biblical treatments we have is getting good oxygen. Now, one of the things I advise my patients do is practice taking deep breaths. Take a deep breath, friend, and hold it for a few seconds and blow it out. Do that 10 times and you'll start to feel the oxygen level go up in your body. The body is very dependent on oxygen. And as we do this, we can get oxygen to the tissues. We think better. We feel better. We can help counteract some of these bad pollutants out there. So try to do some deep breathing exercises today.
If you'd like more information, go to heartwiseministries.org. That's heartwiseministries.org.
We live in a fast-paced, stressed-out world. Is there any way to escape life's intense pressure? Hi, this is Charles Mills, and I'd like to offer you some hope. From my office, I can look out and see the deep blue of the sky and the rich greens of the plants and trees. Scientists tell us that these colors foster a sense of peace and tranquility. Isn't it amazing that God would create the world with a built-in stress reliever for our troubled minds? In a similar way, our wise Creator has designed a spiritual refuge for us. It's found in taking time each day to immerse ourselves in His Word. I'd like to offer you a free series of Bible study lessons that can help you establish a pattern of daily Bible study. It's called Discover, and you can receive the first of these beautiful lessons by calling 800-775-4673. Color your world with messages of hope, peace, and assurance. Ask for Discover when you call 800-775-4673. Welcome back to Simple Solutions. I'm your host, Charles Mills. We're here with Dr. Timothy Jennings, a Christian psychiatrist and author. We're talking about, well, a subject that a lot of people struggle with, both inside themselves and maybe in their family, and that is the subject of suicide. Dr. Jennings has specified that there are two kinds. One is that soldier going out on a suicide mission, knowing that there's a great possibility that he or she will not return, doesn't want to die, but accepts the fact that death may happen. That's a form of suicide, and he said that maybe Christ could even be put in that. He came down here for the sole purpose of dying for us. But then there's another kind, and that's the kind we're talking about today mostly, and that is that suicide that doesn't seem to have reason behind it as far as we see, and conscience behind it. It's brought about with the thoughts of pain without relief, suffering with loss of hope. Dr. Jennings, you mentioned this pain is so much part of people who have suicidal tendencies. What does pain do to the brain's ability to think this stuff through?
Well, I want to clarify what you just said for a second.
Sure.
Because I didn't say there are two types of suicide. I said that from my perspective, I think there's one type of suicide, but in the nomenclature, the way people speak about it, they can use that phrase, a suicide mission. From my perspective, my view is true suicide are those people who actually want to end their lives, not those people who go on a suicide mission. And if they could come home and save their life, they would. They're not suicidal. Yes. They don't want to end their life, but they're willing to lay their life down for others. We call that a suicide mission, but they really don't want to die. Okay.
That's much better.
So, I just was pointing out that sometimes we use that language, but for me, true suicide is somebody who has the intent on ending their own life. Okay, so
now, when someone sits at your office and you're talking to this person and they're saying, you know, I am struggling with life, are there some warning signs that pop up during that conversation, maybe some body language that you recognize might be a precursor to suicidal thoughts and tendencies?
Yeah, warning signs and risk factors kind of go hand in hand. The more risk factors themselves are warning signs. And the risk factors are, the greatest risk factors are comorbid mental health problems. Somebody has a bipolar disorder, depression, and we're talking that is in a current decompensated state. Not somebody has those disorders, but they're well-treated and they're in a normal, healthy mood and they're not having symptoms. that doesn't put them at risk at that time. It's when they have a decompensated state. So somebody's in the doldrums of depression. The doldrums of depression itself is a risk factor and a sign that the risks of suicide go up. So you want to watch for that. Same thing if somebody has a history of substance use problems, but they haven't had, they're a recovered alcoholic. They're involved in good programs and treatment. They haven't had a drink in years. Their risk is not significantly high. But if they're unrecovered or they're actively, they've relapsed back into binge drinking or some sort, the use of the substance while they're using it makes them at a significant increased risk. Okay, so we would watch for those things. And of course, a person who is a substance user and has recovered and has done well for years, and you see a relapse of that behavior suddenly, and if that relapse is happening in conjunction with some major life stressor, their portfolio just was lost, and they lost everything on Wall Street, their house is being foreclosed on, and so forth and so on, and suddenly they're out drinking again, there's a major risk factors and red flags going up. Somebody needs to watch that person very carefully and assess what's going on there. And so risk factors we look for are a sudden change in behavior, depressive-like symptoms and syndromes. I think 70% of suicides happen when somebody has depression or are in a depressed state. So it's a major risk factor. When people begin disengaging from their normal routines of life, social isolation, sometimes people will attempt to do things to make peace with their passing, and they can actually have a brief brightening right before they've come to terms. They've been suffering. They've been miserable. They don't know how and they've come to accept, hey, I'm going to be free because I'm going to end my life next week. And suddenly, because they've made that resolution in their mind, they've got the door open. They're no longer under the oppression that was causing such misery in their mind, and they can have a brief brightening, and then they're dead next week. And they're bright, not because they're well, but because they've accepted they don't have to suffer under whatever it is they were struggling with, because they're going to escape it. And so you can see that sometimes. And sometimes people will try to maybe give away some things because they want to leave part of themselves with people that they care about, and they can give a little memento of some sort that was meaningful behind to people as a way of saying goodbye. So these are all types of factors and risk factors you can watch for. But what I want to tell your audience is if you're suspecting somebody, even if they don't tell you, but you're suspicious, you see a downturn, you see that they're depressed, you see that they're suffering in agony, you see they're suffering in pain, financial suffering, you know that the person is in turmoil, you're worried about them, they deny suicidality. Even if they deny it, you can still, if you're suspicious, mitigate that risk by offering hope. Hope diminishes risk of suicide. And we offer hope. And this is if you're a mental health practitioner listening and you've got somebody in your office and they're telling you they're suicidal, they're telling you they're depressed, they're telling you they're hurting, they're telling you they're miserable. And what I do in my practice all the time is I acknowledge that, I validate their experience, but then I tell them that this is treatable and we can make this go away. I say, I have confidence we can treat this with proper treatment. And then if they have a history of depression, and most people have a history because, you know, they've had more than one episodes, and I will even draw on that history and say, do you remember when you were depressed back at 19 and how bad you felt? Yes. Did that depression go away? Yes. And did you feel good? Were you happy? Did you do a lot of things? Yes. Okay. From your own experience, not just from my word now, you know that with proper treatment, this can go away. You're not going to be stuck here. You're not trapped. There's another way out. Offering that hope is a significant weapon to reduce the risk of suicide, and that's something we need to do. Same thing with people in chronic pain. I know you're hurting, but with proper treatment, we can reduce that pain.
So the idea of getting across that it's possible to come out of this thing, you're dealing with a mind, Dr. Jennings, that is really closed to these thoughts because I'm sure that he or she has said, is there a way out? They're not seeing a way. Are you saying that a professional such as yourself knows things, and this is a self, I mean, the answer is obvious, but I think to some people it may not be, that a professional such as yourself actually has answers that the person, him or herself, doesn't have. Is that what you're saying?
There's no question about that, and that's a twofold answer. One, if you had any type of medical illness, does the healthcare professional have insights and answers that you, the non-professional, doesn't have on any circumstance? Sure. I mean, that's the whole point. Not just medical illness. If your car breaks down, does the professional mechanic have insights and answers that you don't have? Okay, so sure, there are answers out there that others have that we don't have. That's the obvious yes answer. But there's another aspect to this, and that is when people find themselves in a suicidal situation, depressed, suicidal, using substances, there are actual brain changes that occur. When people have depression, we actually have loss of supporting cells called glia. We have loss of connections between neurons. We have loss of neurons. We have volume losses in critical brain regions, including the brain regions where we reason and think things through clearly. We have overactivation of the centers of the brain that gives us a conviction of wrongdoing. And so we can actually feel more oppressed with guilt, more oppressed with inferiority, more oppressed with a worthlessness and hopelessness during a time of depression because that brain region is hyperactive. And the brain region that would help us see more clearly is actually hypoactive. It's not working well. And there's actually tissue loss there. And so people's ability to actually reasonably see what's happening around them becomes narrowed, and they get a distorted view of the world, and thus they draw this conclusion they're trapped with no way out. One of the things I do is I help explain this, what they're going through. I validate what you're experiencing real. Here's the reasons why. Good news is we can treat this with proper treatment. These brain changes are reversed, and you're going to be able to reason, think again. That oppressive guilt and misery is going to go away, and people, you throw a lifeline of hope that they hold to. And then with proper treatment, they experience that, and we can get them well.
What do you do, Dr. Jennings, when that patient sitting across from you with those suicidal tendencies is 13 years old? You cannot say, remember back in your life, and they're only 13 years old. They haven't had the experiences you're talking about. How do you treat a 13-year-old with the suicidal tendencies?
Well, I think I need to first say I don't treat 13-year-olds. I treat 15-year-olds and up, so I've never treated a 13-year-old.
All right, make that 15.
Okay. So the audience ought to know that I'm an adult psychiatrist that treats adolescents from 15 years old and up, and I don't treat the very young kids, so I don't have personal experience to draw on there. I can talk the theory about things, but from my experience with 15-year-olds, it's still the same general principle. 15-year-olds generally don't want to die. What they want is they want to escape whatever misery they're in. And when you're an adolescent, the misery is often twofold. There's often a biological process going on, both the transition of the hormones that come in adolescence causing significant brain changes to occur. And in adolescence, when the hormones hit and the way the brain develops, the limbic system, which is the part of the brain where we get our emotions, is very, very activated by the hormonal changes. But the part of the brain where we do our reasoning, our thinking, our ability to process our emotions, that part of the brain develops later in life. In fact, doesn't fully develop till around 24, 25 years of age. And so, and just to give the audience a sense of what I mean, the part of the brain that gives our emotions, if you ever had that experience of somebody cutting you off the interstate and you get that angry, irritable, frustrating emotion that causes you to maybe even want to say an ugly word or two, that's your limbic system. But if you instantly process that and you go, wait a minute, hold on, he's probably having a bad day, and you work that out and you say, I'm not going to react ugly, and you let it go, that's your prefrontal cortex, that reasoning part right behind your forehead, that's processing those powerful emotions and coming up with a better solution. Adolescents, they get the hormones inflaming those emotional centers, but they don't yet have full capacity of their prefrontal cortexes to process them very well. And so they can often feel overwhelmed, and they can feel in black holes, they can feel discouraged. And what they need is interventions in their life that allow them to process their powerful emotions, offer them assistance in their prefrontal cortex working through. So a therapist is helping them, using basically as an advocate or an external prefrontal cortex, helping them walk through the process of working it through, where they can come to seeing the struggles they're going with in a different light. And they're able to do this. I do this with 15-year-olds all the time, and they want a different perspective. They don't want to feel that distress, that anxiety, that pressure, that peer pressure, that sense of feeling out of place. And so they often end up suicidal because they're having these powerful emotions, and then they can be in a social situation, a peer group situation, in which they're under terrible, incredible pressure. And those things then can lead to a sense of hopelessness, trapped, no way out, and then they look for the escape of suicide. And so we offer them other ways out in therapy, and most of them will grab that if you have that lifeline there for them.
Well, we're going to talk more about this with Dr. Timothy Jennings, Christian psychiatrist and author. We will return to this program. Our phone lines are now open for your questions and comments. 800-775-4673. That's 800-775-4673. Stay tuned.
Let me tell you about one of the most encouraging websites on the internet, www.bibleinfo.com. Why? Well, because nothing lifts the human spirit better than the Word of God, and there's no other website better prepared to deliver what the Bible says than BibleInfo.com.
Choose from over 340 different topics on what the Bible says about life's big questions.
Ask a Bible question or submit a prayer request for a friend or loved one, and we'll pray with you.
If you don't own a computer or are not currently online, call BibleInfo.com at 1-800-97-BIBLE on your touch-tone phone.
You can even speak with a Bible specialist if you call between 5 and 9 p.m. and select menu option number 4. That number is 1-800-97-BIBLE.
The quick and easy way to find out what the Bible says about life's big questions.
Through the internet at www.BibleInfo.com. Or on your touch-tone phone at 1-800-97-BIBLE. Sponsored by your local Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Thank you for listening to Vibrant Life. We trust you're enjoying the program. Today's show is brought to you in part by Vibrant Life magazine and produced in the studios of Life Talk Radio. If you missed some of the discussion, you can contact us to get a copy of today's program. Write to Vibrant Life Radio, P.O. Box 3006, Collegedale, Tennessee, 37315, or email vibrantlife@lifetalk.net. Of course, you can call to request a copy. The toll-free number is 1-800-775-4673. That's 1-800-775-HOPE. You can also listen to Vibrant Life archived online at our website. Go to lifetalk.net and click on Audio Archives. Select Vibrant Life and then choose your topic of interest. Now stay with us for the second half of the program.
Jesus said in John 14:27, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not be afraid." Do you long for that peace in your life? Let's return to Simple Solutions with Christian psychiatrist and author, Dr. Timothy Jennings. Welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Charles Mills. I'll remind our listeners that we have a book to give away today for our callers at 800-775-4673. We have a copy of Could It Be This Simple? Dr. Jennings' Biblical Model for Healing the Mind. And this is a must-read for anyone who wants to get closer to their own mind and to the God who made that mind. We have that book available. We'll take a drawing at the end of the program from our callers today at 800-775-4673. Also, we invite you to visit Dr. Jennings' websites, www.commonreason.com and timjenningsmd.com. You can get the book from there. Also, we can get the DVD set here, Healing the Mind, which is a wonderful set. My wife and I are looking at that this last weekend, as a matter of fact. And there's wonderful teachings here to let you be more in tune with God, what God had in mind for your brain. Good things to learn from both of those. The website, once again, is commonreason.com and timjenningsmd.com. Check those out right away. Again, our phone lines are open for your questions and comments, 800-775-4673. We're talking about a subject that might be a little touchy for some people, and that may be why you want to listen instead of call, but it's up to you. You can call if you want, 800-775-4673. Suicide, Dr. Jennings says, is the lack of hope. If people can be given hope and a change of perspective, if you can change your perspective just slightly, you can find avenues out of that. Dr. Jennings, I'm going to ask you a question now that I just know that you have heard over and over again. You are a Christian psychiatrist, and I'm sure that there have been people who say to you, hey, if you're having suicidal tendencies, you're not walking close enough to God. You have to have a better prayer life. You need to go to church more often. In other words, suicidal tendency is a result of a spiritual decline in your life. And if you just get right with God, those go away. What do you say to that?
Well, in the grand scheme of things, all suffering, disease, illness would have not occurred on this planet if Adam and Eve would have never sinned. So if Adam and Eve would never sinned, there would be perfection and there would be no illness of any kind. And so if you want to put under a broad brushstroke that suicide happens because sin entered the world, I think we could all agree that that's probably true, wouldn't we?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that somebody who is suicidal necessarily has a spiritual walk problem. As I mentioned earlier, 70% of suicides happen to people who are depression. Depression is a brain illness where the brain is no longer functioning as it was designed. We're 6,000 years from the hand of God. There's a lot of genetic defects that have entered our gene pool. Not only that, not only have gene defects entered our gene pool, what science is now showing, it's incredible, it's a whole new field of study called epigenetics, that the behaviors you engage in right now in your life change not the genes you have, but how those genes are expressed. And those expression changes are passed along to your children, including things like vulnerability to mental illnesses and substance abuse and even memory efficiency that this emerging data is suggesting. So, you know, if you're a person who struggles with depression, well, you know, you were first off, born with genes that made you vulnerable. Secondly, the way those genes are expressed make you vulnerable. Third, some of the experiences you had in childhood, we know, for instance, childhood traumas, childhood abuse alters neural development, and the brain doesn't wire in the same way as a child who is not abused in childhood, and that increases the vulnerability to mood disorders and suicidality. Is it a child's fault that they were born with defective genes? Is it a child's fault that they were molested or abused when they were 3, 4, or 5 years of age? And then is it a child's fault that their brain was not wired in a way that would make them more able to process negative emotions and then subsequently develop depression with suicidal thoughts? Should we look at that child and say, now that you were born with these defective genes, now that you were molested by your own parents from age 3 to 7, now that you're 19 years of age and you're suicidal, you've got a spiritual problem. You should feel guilty because you're this horrible sinner. I mean, that kind of talking that comes out of preachers in America only does the devil's work. I'll just tell you straight up. It's the devil's work to discourage. It is not, it's not the truth. The truth is that we are 6,000 years from the hand of God. There are physical defects in our gene pool, and somebody suffering with suicidality oftentimes has no spiritual, primary spiritual problems as the cause of their current suffering. Unless you want to say, and you could make the argument, well, a parent who molests their child does so because there are spiritual problems involved in that relationship. Well, of course, but not in the child's fault. A healthy, a parent with a good walk with Christ and a genuinely loving Christ-like heart is not going to molest their kids. So you could trace that back to a spiritual problem, but not put that on the shoulders of the child who's molested.
How far can you carry this, Dr. Jennings? Like the old comedian said, the devil made me do it. How much can we use the fact that we're 6,000 years from the hand of God as an excuse for our behavior?
I didn't say excuse for our behavior. I said excuse for our symptoms or syndromes or illnesses that we struggle with. I didn't say behavior. I didn't say that because we're 6,000 years from the hand of God, we are powerless over the choices we make and have no opportunities for a remedy or treatment or healthy behavior. I'm saying that we don't blame ourselves for the fact we struggle with powerful emotions of discouragement or even feelings of suicidal thoughts or temptations. Temptations come to everyone, but we, through God's grace, have the power to make choices to experience healing. And so too, that child who was born with defective genes, that child who was abused by their parents and had some wiring changes in their brain where their fear centers were oversensitized and their reasoning powers or reasoning centers are not fully developed, and so they're more prone to mood problems and suicidal risks later in life. So too, those kids, as adults, can experience healing. They can actually make choices to engage in therapy, to make choices to get the proper remedies to bring to bear, both spiritual, physical, biological, psychological remedies that actually result in further brain changes in a healthy direction. So just because we find ourselves in this circumstance doesn't mean we're hapless and helpless.
800-775-4673 is our phone number if you'd like to ask a question on this topic or any topic. As a matter of fact, Dr. Jennings is here to serve you. 800-775-4673. We have a copy of Could It Be This Simple? A wonderful book by Dr. Jennings. We'll have a drawing for that at the end of the program for our callers. That's 800-775-4673.
Hey, Charles.
Dr. Jennings.
Charles.
Go ahead.
Hey, did you happen to see in the USA Today, February 6, 2009, the suicides in the Army rise sharply in January?
Yes, above those of the civilian population.
Not only that, they found that more people, more soldiers in January died by suicide than by Al-Qaeda.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
There were 24 Army soldiers in the month of January that are suspected of dying of suicide. They do in the military, they do something called, after it's over, a psychological autopsy. I used to be the division psychiatrist of the 24th and 3rd Infantry Divisions, served 7 years as a military psychiatrist and for the U.S. Army. And we used to do, in the aftermath of a suicide, something called a psychological autopsy, where you basically go and you interview everybody who is associated with the soldier that you can possibly interview, look over medical records, service records, and you try to piece together what was going on that brought that soldier to the point of suicide. And the most common, and of course you understand that soldiers, they recruit soldiers 17 to 19 to 20 are the prime recruitment age. So these are young people who are in late adolescence. Prefrontal cortex is not still fully developed. It doesn't finish developing until around 24. They take them away from their support structures. They move them from their home, their families, where they've grown up, put them in a high-stress environment, generally easy access to alcohol, which is a well-known phenomenon in the military, which increases vulnerability. They end up being deployed into a high-stress environment. And then least it was when I was in, the biggest risk factor to a soldier suiciding is the Dear John letter. Their girlfriend, their wife, somebody ends that relationship with them when they're isolated away from their family. They can't get to them. They can't go and work out the relationship. They feel this tremendous loss from this support. I don't know if you remember, but during World War II, you couldn't divorce a soldier during World War II. Wasn't allowed. Okay, because it was too demoralizing to the soldiers being deployed. So you had to wait until they returned to do that type of thing. Again, what is then the reason for a soldier in this situation? Well, they're high stress. They're seeing a lot of traumatic experiences, which is difficult for them to process because it's activating the limbic system, but prefrontal cortex, which processes those stimuli, isn't fully developed yet to really process it in the most efficient manner possible. Then you maybe throw a little alcohol on board, and then you get this breakup relationship thing. It can feel like life is overwhelming. They're trapped. They're lost. They'll never be happy. They'll never be able to connect with anybody again, and thus they're increasing the risk for suicide.
Now, when a soldier like that came to you, doctor, when you were involved with the military, what did you say to him or her?
Well, every circumstance is different, but ultimately you want to get to know the individual first, try to understand where they're coming from, what their stresses are, where they perceive the pain bearing down on their life, what they value, what's important, and then you take and begin to open their mind to a different view. You offer hope that this can be better. You empathize with their pain and let them know that you understand, and then you begin to hopefully help them see that there are other avenues of escape from the pain besides the ultimate escape from, which is the escape from life altogether.
Now, you've been discussing cognitive therapy here, dealing with these issues. Is there anything you can do as far as diet or lifestyle that can help you deal with suicidal tendencies and thoughts?
Well, anything that helps you be healthier physically gives the brain resilience to resist to a certain degree the stressors of life. So, for instance, routine exercise, aerobic exercise, which of course soldiers get a lot of, does increase brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It's a factor that keeps the neurons healthy. That's a great thing. A routine sleep, which soldiers,
of course, jogging around the park and jogging around Baghdad, two different places. I mean, you could have exercise in a really bad place, and it's not going to help you too much, right?
Well, that's a good point. And the reason for that is actually they've done studies on exercise, and if they put people in exercises which they enjoy, they actually get physiologic benefit from it. If they put people in exercise burning the same calories, same heart rate, same expenditure of energy, but it's an exercise they don't enjoy, they actually dislike it, they actually don't get the physiologic benefits, they actually get the bad stress hormones being released, and it turns things in the wrong direction. And so it's not just the exercise alone, it's the mental attitude toward the exercise. So soldiers getting exercise in a combat zone are probably not going to get the physiologic benefits that you would get if you were actually, you know, rowing or biking or doing something you actually enjoy. So that's a really, really good point.
How about diet? You talk about this on your DVD set, Healing the Mind. What about diet? What should we do there?
Well, diet can be helpful just to maintain physiologic health and brain health, but again, it's not going to necessarily resolve suicidal thoughts. But if the healthier we are, the more resilient we are at resisting these things. And so there's some dietary things that we want to do. Omega-3 fatty acids are really good for brain health. They come from fish oils, flaxseed, black walnuts, things like that. B vitamins and folates are very important in keeping the brain healthy as well. So generally a healthy, balanced diet and a diet that is more plant-based than animal-based is actually good science demonstrating it's better for the brain and body health than an animal-based diet. But again, that's only to keep the physiology healthy. It's not a solution in itself.
All right. 800-775-4673 for your questions and comments. 800-775-4673. We'll be right back.
Too many Christians don't know the truth about dinosaurs, but Christian scientist Dr. Elaine Graham Kennedy is out to change that. Dr. Kennedy is a research scientist who has done field work at dig sites in remote places like Patagonia. She has spent her life studying dinosaurs, and now she has published a remarkable book called Dinosaurs, published by Pacific Press, that is both scientifically based and biblically sound. It answers the questions many Christians ask. Did dinosaurs really live? Are dinosaur bones fake? Who made the dinosaurs? What happened to them? And were dinosaurs on Noah's Ark? Dr. Kennedy's book, Dinosaurs, is filled with interesting facts, photographs, and colorful charts. It is a must for every Christian home and perfect for reading with your kids. To get a copy, visit www.pacificpress.com or call 1-800-765-6955.
It's time for a health break with Charles Mills, editor of Vibrant Life magazine.
Researchers recently examined the impact of a short-lived Helena, Montana 2002 smoking ban. Although the ban lasted only 6 months, reverberations from the great smokeout were far-reaching. While the prohibition was in place, heart attack admissions among Helena's residents at the region's one hospital dropped by 60%, moving from an average of 7 per month to just over 3. No similar changes were reported in the surrounding communities. What happened next is just as stunning. The Montana State Legislature, under pressure from the Montana Tavern Association and tobacco lobbyists, rescinded the ban. Heart attack rates shot back up as quickly as they'd fallen. If you smoke, stop. If you don't smoke, stay away from those who do.
To discover even more ways to enjoy physical health, mental clarity, and spiritual balance, check out VibrantLife.com.
Welcome back to Simple Solutions with Dr. Timothy Jennings, Christian psychiatrist and author. He is author of the book, Could It Be This Simple?, and also of the DVD set, Healing the Mind. Both of these resources are available at his websites. You can go to www.comeandreason.com. That's www.comeandreason.com. Also, if you want to talk to him personally, send a message to him, you can go to timjenningsmd.com. That's www.timjenningsmd.com. Okay, we're talking about suicide here. We've discussed what it is, what it isn't, how it comes about. Let's talk about treatment here, Dr. Jennings, in the latter part of our program. By the way, listener, our phone lines are open, 800-775-4673. If you have a question or comment, I'm sure that we're not asking all the questions you'd like to have asked, and here's your opportunity to put them in there, 800-775-4673. What are some of the treatments that... You talked about healing the mind by help the body, a healthy body helps heal an unhealthy mind. what can we do besides diet and exercise to help get our minds back where they need to be?
Well, if you said our show today is really a crisis intervention show. It's not primarily about treating the underlying illness. It's about when somebody is suicidal, what do we do? So we will talk about the underlying illness in a moment. But the first thing to do, if you suspect somebody is suicidal, this is an emergency situation and you don't ignore it. You have to take action. And so there's things you can do depending on the circumstances. You don't leave them alone. You don't even leave them alone for a few minutes. If you really suspect somebody is suicidal, you don't even leave them alone to go to the bathroom, because in the bathroom they pull out a razor and cut their wrists, or they take an overdose and so forth. So if you really think somebody is eminently suicidal, you stay with them until you can get them professional help. There's an 800 number, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's 1-800-273-TALK. 1-800-273-8255 is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And so that's a resource that you can call if you're concerned about somebody having suicidal thoughts. But if somebody is suicidal, you have to intervene to get them professional help, because they might not be there if you don't. With that being said, what interventions do professionally, what we do if somebody's suicidal, we actually admit them to a psychiatric hospital or unit where they are watched until we're convinced they're not suicidal anymore. They are put on an observation in which a professional attendant is with them every moment of every day with their eyes on them until they're at a point where we're convinced they have recovered the capacity to resist the urges to harm self. And even though they still may be depressed, still may be struggling with problems, they've had an internal change such that, hey, I don't want to die anymore. I want to work with you to get well, even though I'm still feeling depressed and lousy. I'm not going to kill myself. And at that point, then they don't have to be watched every incident of every day. But if they're really suicidal, we need to take measures to protect them.
I'm going to jump in here, okay. Dr. Jennings. We have a caller that would like to talk to you from Georgia by the name of Bob. Bob, how can we help you today?
Well, as we all know very well, some of us more well than others, the economic situation in our country is pretty devastating to a lot of people. I think at this particular juncture in our economic lifetimes, there has been very few things that have impacted so many people so drastically. And a lot of those kinds of people who don't have any hope, as we have spoken of before, are choosing the end your life result as a way to get out from overburdening bills, mortgages that aren't paid, foreclosure, and the loss of dignity that goes with that. Is there something specific that can be said, done, or provided to this kind of a mentality that would help in that situation?
Bob, that is an excellent question. That is an incredibly timely question, and I appreciate you calling and asking it. One of the things I do in a circumstance like that is basically bring some reality and truth to bear. Even though it is reality that they're having financial loss, and it's reality that they might have a foreclosure going, and they might even have to file bankruptcy. What happens is most of us have our sense of well-being, our sense of value as a person tied to some of these things, and then we feel this internal sense of failure, as you said, humiliation or embarrassment or public shame, or all these things can come to bear in on it, which really aren't appropriate to the circumstance. And so what I do is I do several things. One, I help them realize we don't live in old England in which debtors go to debtor's prison. Okay, they don't take your kids. They don't lock them up. They don't put you in prison. You don't become an indentured servant. You don't become a slave. Okay, so even though it may be the reality that you have to go through a bankruptcy procedure, you don't end up losing your autonomy or individuality. I also then point out that some of the greatest successes in life, Conrad Hilton and others, went through several bankruptcies before they actually ended up being, you know, mega millionaires. And so bankruptcy in itself, and then I point out how corporations, Delta recently bankrupted, lots of things go through bankruptcies, which are not actually the end of everything. It's a restructuring, a reorganization, a way to step back and say, okay, let me reorganize to move forward in a constructive way. And then the third thing, which is important to do, is step back and see our current circumstance on earth from a spiritual perspective, from a larger view. What's happening? What is the ultimate end game here? Is the ultimate end game that we get our mortgage paid off in a house that's going to burn when Christ comes again? Or is the ultimate end game to have an eternal retirement plan where we end up with eternal security? And so we reframe from their belief system and spiritual basis an understanding of their current circumstances that can be internalized in a way that is not so devastating to the self that they can actually process and live with.
Hmm. Well, that helps a great deal, with one exception. It's difficult to communicate to that somebody who has no paycheck and 3 or 4 or 12 mouths to feed. And the circumstances that they find themselves in sometimes seem hopeless. And unfortunately, many of them feel like ending their life will take the weight from them, but it leaves it on the kids that are left behind with still empty mouths.
See, and you just gave an intervention. You see, they're feeling for these kids that they're feeling the pressure not being able to provide for them. They're feeling guilty. They're feeling inadequate. They're feeling like they're being a burden to these kids and so forth and so on. And so what you do is you step back right there as well. And you say, okay, let's deal with that. You do offer hope. I mean, what I will do in my practice, I will, you get them in touch with social services so they can get on food stamps if they need to. There are community kitchens and other types of things. So real resources to get those kids fed. And that's another reality of our day in life compared to the old world where kids would starve. Kids really won't starve in this country today, at least not currently. It hasn't got that bad. There will be food and there will be people that will help feed that family if that was what the circumstances were. So you offer that hope as well. But you also bring back the reality of what will it do? Your concern for your kids. You validate that. You affirm that. You build that desire stronger and then you connect. And what will it do to your kids when you die? How will you be there to help them through this difficult time? Don't they need to see you and the witness you give them that life throws us some difficult circumstances? They're looking for you to learn lessons on how they're going to handle their future problems in life. Do you want to give them the lesson when times get tough, you give up and quit and even kill yourself? Or do you want to give them the lessons when times get tough? Through God's grace, we're going to find a way to get through this together, and we pull together as a family.
I agree that's the method. I disagree that it's as seemingly easy as we speak of it. I don't think that was your intention, but certainly there are an awful lot of hurting people out there that we as Christians and people that care can be Christ's hands and his feet and his arms full of whatever it is that can help those people in their times of distress.
I agree with you completely. I didn't say it was easy. I think that the application, I mean, when we can talk about the understanding of the road to walk and then actually going out and doing it can be quite difficult to do. But I think the process of what I'm talking about is the direction that we need to work with that person on and ultimately change their perspective to see that they're staying in the fight, they're staying involved, engaged in the process, working for a solution. Even if there are difficult times to bear, and then what I often do is I will bring lots of historical references to bear about families and circumstances where they went through difficult times. Families in Nazi Germany, for instance, who stayed together and with very meager resources, but yet how they came through that together and the strength that they built for each other and how they overcame during those difficult times. Use those historical references to show that your focus here as a parent is not simply to provide food. Your focus here as a parent is to help instill in your child traits of character, resolve, hope, love that will help them for a lifetime, not just for the next few weeks.
Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate that. And since we don't have time for more calls, Bob, you are the winner of our book, Simple Solutions. We'll be sending that right out to you. Thank you so much for your call. I guess the bottom line is, Dr. Jennings, sometimes we have to face up to the ugly reality that it's hard to live this life. It's hard to stay in this life. It's hard to make something of this life. And even though we are down, we don't have to be out. And with equally hard work, we can get back up. Is that what you're telling us?
Absolutely. Because we know that there is an eternal reward coming, because we know that that there's a resurrection after this life, that there is a new heaven and a new earth, that we always have hope. And we also know that things are actually going to get tough before they actually get better. We often go through difficult problems and trials, but those trials are not the end. Those trials are serving and opportunities for us to demonstrate Christ's love through difficult times. It's easy to be kind and gracious when things are great. It's much more telling when things are tough.
In the last 30 seconds of our show, Dr. Jennings, would you pray for those that Bob mentioned, people out there suffering right now?
Father in heaven, we ask that you would send your agencies, your angels, your spirit to minister to those around this world who are struggling with difficult times, who are discouraged, who are being tempted to maybe end their life. We ask that you will let them see the hope of your heart, hope of your plan for their life, hope of healing, and let them reach out and connect with somebody that can be your hands on this earth to help them. We pray in your holy name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Dr. Jennings. We appreciate your words of wisdom. Our topic next week will be fighting depression, which can be a precursor to the subject of this week. Listener, thank you so much for being with us. So we'll mention that website at the close of the program. Until next week, this is Charles Mills with Dr. Timothy Jennings inviting you to apply the simple solutions God placed in your heart today. Goodbye, everyone. Simple Solutions is a production of Life Talk Radio and Dr. Timothy Jennings and is made possible by your generous support. For more information, visit www.comeandreason.com.